My name is Michael McCusker. So, here we are. April Fools, snake-eyed by a convicted felon masquerading as American democracy's savior, all the while dismantling liberty and justice for all in an all-consuming quest for dictatorial anarchy. Donald Trump is a criminal who in a just and sane society will go to jail at the end of his presidency as a convicted felon. Yet, in a just and sane society, he would never have been elected president, which is a primary reason he has nothing to lose by seizing the government. He has already infiltrated the nation's capital with his toadies, who might in fact be considered homegrown fascists, not unlike Hitler's original brown shirts. And he is beating the drum for a third term, which is denied by the Constitution. And he is savagely using his presidential powers to avoid the jailhouse by figuratively seizing the White House in perpetuity as perpetual president, aka Hitleresque burlesque. The flattery, fantasy of adding Donald Trump's visage to Mount Rushmore is a disgusting example of the sordid mockery of democracy of the USA under Trump's criminal presidency. And now, following that rant, I would like now to finish an article I wrote for the Once Upon a Time North Coast Times Eagle about the hoped-for possibility of a woman president, which was a real opportunity this past election, unfortunately trumped by the re-election of the nation's criminal-in-chief to a second term under which the entire Western Hemisphere currently trembles, plus Greenland. So now, in a countervailing vein to Trumpian tyranny, part two of Ms. Smith Goes to Washington, which I wrote for the now immortal North Coast Times Eagle. The 20th century started with more than 5 million women working at outside employment, about one-fifth of all U.S. women. The greatest increase was in clerical work, which employed primarily white women. Two other areas of dramatic increase were telephone operators and sales clerks. Nearly 30% of jobs for women were as domestic workers, a large percentage black and immigrants. Others worked on farms as teachers or in factories, primarily garment or textile. In 1909, women shirtwaist workers attempted to organize at two companies in New York City, were fired, and immediately formed a picket line. They persevered despite arrests and beatings by police. Called the Uprising of the 20,000, it was the largest strike of women workers to date. They did not win many of their demands, but were supported by the Women's Trade Union League and proved that women were able to organize. 2 years later, on March 25, 1911, fire broke out at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, where the 1909 strike began. Exits were locked against the law, and fire ladders were unable to reach the top floors. So 146 workers, most of them young immigrant women, jumped into the street or burned to death. Rose Schneiderman gave an impassioned speech, and thousands of mourners marched down Fifth Avenue. "This is not the first time girls have been burned alive in this city," Schneiderman said. "Every week I must learn of the untimely death of one of my sister workers. Too much blood has been spilled. I know from my experience it is up to working people to save themselves. The only way they can save themselves is by a strong working-class movement." The shirtwaist factory owners were acquitted following an investigation that was as corrupt as it was scandalous. Massachusetts passed the first minimum wage law for women in 1912. Other states passed similar laws, but the U.S. Supreme Court disavowed them in 1923. The justices contended that with the vote, women were essentially equal with men and no longer needed special protection, quote unquote. The decision knocked out all existing state minimum wage laws, but the court reversed itself in 1937 and upheld a Washington state minimum wage law for women. In its decision, the court deplored the exploitation of a class of workers who are in an unusual position with respect to bargaining power, and that's a quote, and said, to quote again, what these workers lose in wages, the taxpayers are called upon to pay. The bare cost of living must be met, unquote. During World War I, women took over many men's jobs, working in blast furnaces, smelting brass and copper, producing chemicals, and manufacturing automobiles and railway parts. Women operated streetcars and elevators and delivered the mail. Their wartime work led to formation of the Women in Industrial Service in the Department of Labor in 1918. Later, the Women's Bureau in 1920. After the war, women lost their jobs and higher pay for the returning men. After Pearl Harbor, which catapulted America into World War II, the government urged industry to tap into woman power, and that's a quote, for the intense labor effort necessary to win World War II. The defense industry alone hired 2 million women during the war. They built airplanes and ships, assembled machine guns, operated railroads, and wired electrical equipment. Altogether, 6 million new women entered the labor force, including large numbers of married and non-white women, although 50,000 Japanese-American women were interned in detention camps. Congress passed the 1942 Lapham Act, which established public nurseries for the children of working women, but only until the end of the war. At the end of World War II in 1945, many women lost their jobs, especially in heavy industry, replaced as they were following World War I by returning males. In the Detroit auto industry, for example, women employees dropped from 25% to 7.5% of the workforce, despite protests from UAW women leaders, who by 1944 had their own division in the union. Before women were forced back into domesticity at war's end, they had a total national union membership of 3 million, increased from about 800,000 in 1940. Yet by 1950, almost 30% of all American women worked and represented about one-fourth of the total workforce. More than half of single women had jobs, and nearly a quarter of married women, a big increase from 1940. In 1960, about 35% of American women worked, including more than 30% of married women. Rate of pay dropped, however, averaging 60 cents for every $1 men earned, down from 1955's 63 cents for every male $1. Women of color averaged 42 cents. About 30% worked in clerical jobs. Black women, about 11%. In 1970, close to 44% of women worked, including about 41% of married women. women moved to skilled trades as carpenters, electricians, plumbers, and machinists. However, most women were still concentrated in poorly paid jobs. Average women's wages dropped to about 59 cents for every male $1, even less for women of color, although the gap between white and non-white women narrowed. In 1980, more than half of women were in the workforce, including just over 50% of married women. They continued to earn an average of 59 cents to every male $1. At the top level, 427 of the top 1,300 American corporations had at least one woman on the board of directors, almost double the number of 4 years earlier. Also, the number of women-owned businesses increased 56% in the previous decade, five times the rate of men. In 1985, the number of women in management positions had doubled since 1965, from 14% to 33%. Yet one-third of women were still in low-paying clerical jobs. Even in new fields, women were overrepresented at the bottom and underrepresented at the top, a condition that continues to exist. For example, in 1985, only one-third of computer programmers were women, compared to two-thirds of word processor and computer operators, which has not significantly changed. About three-fourths of women ages 25 to 54 were wage earners in 1990. About 24% of lawyers were women, compared to only 3% two decades earlier. Almost half of all accountants were women, double the number of two decades before. Similar gains were made in other professions. By 1987, there were close to 300 women on the boards of major U.S. companies, almost double the number of 4 years earlier. By 2000, women owned more than one-fourth of American businesses, three times as many as in 1980. Men still held 95% of top management jobs in the biggest corporations, however, and though the gap between men's and women's average earnings has narrowed, women still make on average about 70 cents for every $1 men make. All issues are women's issues, Geraldine Ferraro said the year she campaigned as vice president, which is exactly the point of this chronology, only a partial account of women's role in the structure of American history, but an example of the depth and complexity of that participation. Debbie Twombly, a founding member of the North Coast Women's History Project, wrote in the North Coast Times-Eagle in March 1989, "During recent years, women have reached into the past to gain a hold on our roots. The results have been an affirmation of our worth, and finally a documentation of the contributions of our foremothers. History lessons have basically taught children that women have been invisible in the development of our country, but gradually women are being written back into history. As we learn more, surely a positive reaction will be the gradual awareness that women have always been a part of our past, and girls will begin to feel worthy of a place in history. Optimally, we will come to realize that women can reach the historical heights that men have kept for themselves." And that was from Astoria's own Debbie Twombly. The quality of seekers of the presidency have seldom been high, and as the power of the presidency increases, the quality has proportionately declined. The voters are always offered two Christian white men in a polyglot nation in which women are the majority and the great variety of races outnumber Caucasians. There are many reasons a woman ought to be elected the American president. Chances are very good that she will probably be a much better leader than a masculine counterpart, because male culture demands women possess and demonstrate superior skills simply to compete with the reigning supremacy of the killer gender. An excellent example a woman should be president is that women generally represent the most generous and humane prospects of humanity. Women are literally pregnant with our future and provide the true compassion and Gaia wisdom of our species. A common question asked by dubious men and some women, Phyllis Schlafly comes to mind, is, do you think a woman can be better than a man? The response is that she certainly could not do worse. But of course, that is a piggyback negative. A woman ought to be president, simply because, after all this time, a woman deserves to be president. Indispensable to this article has been Timelines of American Women's History by Sue Heinemann. Thanks also to Gerda Lerner for her 1971 book, The Woman in American History, and many others for which there is no room to list as a bibliography. Ms. Smith Goes to Washington originally appeared in the summer 1997 issue of the North Coast Times Eagle. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer for this program. Impeach Trump. We can do it, as well as rid the White House of his autocratic associates. Happy April. Impeach Trump and his lickspittle fools. And now, a poem. Hail to the Chief by Linda McDonald Lewis, with a bit of a prologue. The following poem is written to reflect feelings I have about current events. Historically, the same type of thing happens over and over again with the same results. Don't get me wrong. I'm not for or against one political party or another. I don't care for any politicians. It doesn't matter what country they are from. Hail to the Chief. Don't speak to me of honor and generosity, you viper in a three-piece suit, complete with PhD. The attitude you carry exposes your life's creed based on the filth of power, weighted well with greed. You speak of God's great blessings to the middle class, then speak of jobs and health care to the struggling mass. You find a stately enemy, a focal, pointed foe, to justify your lawless moves to the average Joe. Your rants and raves about this fiend stirs fear throughout the land. Young men line up and then sign up to help you make your stand. You sanctify this violence and teach them how to kill. Their actions, once well scolded for, becomes their life's blood skill. Then, when your term is over and your office time is up, your game produced no winners and no victorious cup. You turn these well-trained killers back onto our streets. Crime rates rise before our eyes. The cycle's now complete. And that was Hail to the Chief by Linda McDonald Lewis.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.